You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Tony Bishara. Tony, thank you so much for being with me today.
Well, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Tony, we're going to talk about your show at Listen Gallery, and that was in running from January through February of 2024. Beautiful, mm-hmm. beautiful show of your work. So let's jump right into it. These are all acrylic paintings that have a relationship almost to pixels, but you started before. Yep. This process before pixels was even a word. Is that correct?
Yeah. It's I've been interested in some form of pointillism or pixelation or color, color appreciation for many, many, many years. I studied law at Georgetown University, but then I decided to become a painter. And while I was painting, I started doing this black and white paintings, in the 60s, and very cinematic. And at one point, I said to myself, if I'm going to be doing this, why don't I make movies? But the idea of working in teams and losing my ability to relate to paint and to canvas was too strong. Ironically, at the time, I was near Venice, and I got to see the mosaics in Venice and in what's the name of the city? Near Venice. I'll tell you in a minute. And I saw these incredible mosaics, and I just was this is early 60s. I just was won over by it. The idea of dealing with optics, dealing with mixing colors in an optical way rather than a chemical way. And so I started my route with pointillism and with pixelation by using, and I have done so now for 30 or 40 years, a quarter inch square, which I create by using a rather complicated system of taping and retaping and taping and retaping, and I just myself got very excited by the process and by the results. I know at the time it was too close to what they used to call op art, which was not very popular in those days. But I stuck with it, and I had this show.
Well, tell me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but tell me about the op art connection. That was something that that was associated with your work, but you were working in a different way. It wasn't about that kind of illusion.
No, it was not about that kind of it, but people misinterpreted it. When they saw, op art is a complicated thing. There was, what was the name of that famous show in the 60s at MoMA? The Elusive Eye, that got whacked, every critic in New York hated it. And the real reason, frankly, was because it was a show in which, for the first time, MoMA was showing Europeans and Latin Americans, and they were incredibly protective of the turf of New York. Now, since the post-war, they wanted to make sure that, you know, nothing new ever happened outside of New York. And this so-called op art, you know, that had optical illusions and all of that, was something that was not being done here. It was being done in Paris. It was being done in South America, in other places. Anyway, it's an aside, but my work was misrepresented by many people to be in the jungle. And however, I knew it wasn't, so I stuck with it. I've had this my first show with Listen here in New York in Chelsea, and I decided that the show was going to be about 28 colors in each painting, the same 28 colors repeated in the other painting. So there were nine.
And then let me just ask you why 28 colors? Why that number? Because it's that's
random.
Something you stuck with. It's random.
Random. Randomness, entropy, all of that stuff fascinated me. And not that I used it all the time, you know. There were times in which when I was painting, since part of my painting process involved painting over areas that have already been covered by tape, I basically paint blind, which is a concept that I find extremely alluring, the idea of painting blind.
What do you mean? What do you mean by painting blind? Because you're carefully taping, you're creating all these layers, right?
That's right. And I couldn't see what was already on my canvas. I mean, I could guess, but I really couldn't see clearly what was underneath the tape, because it involved four major retapings on every painting that I've done. And
but you're choosing a palette beforehand, right? The palette that you have is
that
a surprise.
I chose. That was not random. That I chose. I chose a palette. I have been extremely interested in all of these color theories going back to, my God, Goethe and Joseph Albers, many people, and color theories. And I've been fascinated by them. And the idea of painting as an optical experience rather than a theatrical one or a literary one, or even an abstract one in the sense of reading movements, and I was just more interested in the random aspect of it. The idea that I chose the 28 colors, that's definite. I have the 28 colors, I decided, and I said, these are the 28 colors that I'm going to utilize to cover this canvas with quarter-inch masking tapes, you know, probably, I don't know, 1,000, maybe 28,000 colors, 1,000 of each colors, just repeating it. And then the process of painting and repetition, I drew references to the kind of Sufi elements in which you are engaged in a task which is repetitive and there was an element of in which at some point the painting started kind of painting itself. You know, it was sort of directing me which way I wanted to go. And so it's random, but then nothing in life is random. You know, accident, which is a concept that I'm highly interested in. And I was always hoping and searching for the eureka moment in an accident. I'm convinced that accidents are the source of great breakthroughs, not only in art, but in science, you know. I mean, when Mr. Fleming left his petri dish and ended up discovering penicillin by chance, that's just one of a thousand of those elements, you know. So the concept of an accident was something that I was always really interested in. And I was always searching in my paintings to create the possibilities of things happening beyond my control. However, they were not beyond my control because the system that I have allows me to recreate or repeat. So if there was an accidental choice of colors that ended up creating this interesting area of the canvas, you know, while the tape was off, before I put the tape back on, I sort of wanted to, maybe I want to follow what the painting is telling me in that area over there. And I would. And I did.
There's an element of, just to interrupt, there's an element of chance, but also, is it almost like printmaking? You know, printmaking has that surprise, that chance. And,
absolutely.
And with the peeling up of tape, it seems that there's a little bit of that too, this yeah. surprise element, but of course not completely a surprise. It's sometimes
yeah, absolutely.
A change
when
in
you
composition.
When you pull a lithograph or a serigraph or a Shin Kole, whatever, there's that wonderful element of you really don't know what's going to appear. And sometimes you go with it and you repeat it. Sometimes you discard it. So there is an accidental element. There is the element of randomness. And while at the same time, I really do not believe in those concepts. I try to use them to create this optical engagement between the eye and the brain, an immediate reaction before the eye sends signals to the brain, and the brain decides in through pattern discrimination, this is a house, or this is a photograph of, you know, of a friend or of my parents. Or I was very interested, just like Monet was when he was in his 90s, in that element of a reaction of color combinations to the brain, between the eye and the brain, besides, you know, before the brain explained everything. And then it became just mundane. But that moment, I wanted to recapture, and I'd like to recapture in a lot of the paintings that I make. And that's the part of it that interested me the most. And in that exhibition, I did that. I tried to manipulate the 28 colors as best as I could, going from green to to blue, from blue to yellow, from yellow to red. In sense of quantity or intensity, and I think I achieved that. I'm sorry that it is so difficult to speak about this kind of optical experience.
No, it's not difficult, really. I like speaking about it. I mean, we're talking about it in some ways in technical terms. There's, when I think of some of the influences you mentioned, like Albers and others, some talk of almost kind of meditative experience or even mystical experience, that there's a depth, there's an almost spirituality to this kind of sometimes mathematical perfection almost or imperfection.
Yes.
Is that something that you think about as well?
That is, yes, that is something that I think about. I mentioned Sufi. And, Sufi dancers, when they start spinning around and spinning and spinning and spinning, sometimes in my process is so repetitive and so tedious, that there's an element of spirituality that sets in. I do not reject it at all, I try to use it to enhance the work. And I hope that people, when they look at those paintings and those colors and those color combinations, explore something new. They realize that... Look, to me, the most important thing in any of the arts, and to me, is originality. The idea of doing something that's been done 20 times before doesn't interest me. But to find a way of originality was... and it's very difficult to find it because, there's 10 million artists just in the United States, probably. They're all looking for their own original voice, and it becomes a cacophony of, that cannot be measured. But in my sense, what I wanted the viewer to get is to grasp just how color combinations can change from one millisecond to the next, can change from your moving to the left or walking back 2 feet, before you start trying to define and explain what is it that I'm looking at. Oh, it's color and it's tape, and this looks like an eagle, and that looks like a, which of course is never that, but it's whatever you look at, whatever you see.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me. And it's a process that's steeped in history. And to speak a little bit to your history as in the art world, because I know you've been representative of Carmen Herrera. And also sit on several boards, and so you have an active role in the art world. I want to talk a little bit about that with Carmen Herrera, who of course was quite legendary.
Well, Carmen was my friend for nearly 50 years, almost 40 years, because just by chance, we both moved to 19th Street when it was a kind of an abandoned area in Manhattan. Near Union Square, and we were neighbors, and we became friends. And through the years, there were many artists who lived around here. We all wondered, how come this Carmen is doing such really interesting work, and she's getting absolutely no recognition? So I made it a point to really promote her. And alas, finally, at age of 90, the New York Times and a few other critics discovered her, quote unquote discover her. You know, she'd been doing that work for in Paris in the 40s. You know, and she was a wonderful person. She was she died 2 years ago. She was 106. And to me, she was a great lead into the 19th century, because her parents were born in the 19th century, and Carmen was born in 1915. She was imbued and educated by the standards of 200 years ago. I mean, she was a fascinating woman. And also, you know, I firmly believe in artist social participation. You know, I don't do much marching or yelling or anything like that. But I do believe in engaging in boards. And, you know, I was for many years the chairman of El Museo del Barrio, which is, you know, the Latino Museum up on Fifth Avenue here. And also have been for more than 20 years on the board of BAM, because I used to love the work that BAM was doing. It was, you know, and I think probably influential to my work in some way or other.
How was BAM influential to your work in some way, do you think?
Well, you know, seeing the work that was done there, you know, Merce Cunningham, John Cage, Robert Wilson, the kind of music that was, you know, performed there, the happenings, all of that leaded me towards my concept of randomness, of, you know, trying to be instinctive rather than deductive, and in those in the early years, BAM was the place, you know. Now it's different. There are many other places in New York where you can go see that kind of work. But when I first came to New York, if you wanted to listen to new music or new theater, you went to BAM.
Yeah, I mean, that was quite a time to see those kind of artists at BAM there, too. Yeah, that was
amazing. I mean, I saw the original Einstein on the beach.
Wow.
It was a fascinating time. And also, I looking back in my own life history, I rejected the idea of making films. I rejected the idea of, because I was in law school, I did reject that. But I was, just fascinated by the idea of painters and paintings and the aroma of it, you know. When I first came to New York, I apprenticed with Phil Pavia, who is not that well known today, but was part of the whole crowd of, you know, East 9th Street, 8th Street, of friends with de Kooning and Pollock and the Cedar Bar, that whole scene. And I was, while he was older, I was his assistant. That's how I started, really, in the art world. And through him, I was able to just get a sense of what it was like, you know, the 40s, the 50s in New York. How amazing that must have been. There were, you know, it was interesting. Hardly anybody, any one of those painters that I came across then, hardly anyone or read about went to a university. You know, maybe there's some exceptions, but they were, Pollock, I think, was a house painter from, I don't know, from Washington State or from, Franz Klein was, you know, they were working class. And right. What they learned about painting, they learned the tough way, you know, by looking at the past and looking hard, arguing hard, drinking hard, fighting hard, but only for a few minutes. Then they would all make up. And that was quite formative for me. I mean, I loved being in the kind of in the end of the second generation of abstract expressionism, of seeing, you know, pop art was advancing and they were retreating and being forgotten. Some of them are still forgotten, but history has a way of correcting itself, I hope, because there's a lot of those guys were great painters, and you know, then they were replaced by you know, Warhol and that whole pop business.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking with you, Tony. I want to congratulate you on this show because I really loved it. And I also want to ask you one more question before we go. A little off topic, but I'm always curious what people are reading. What are you reading now?
Well, I am reading the biography of Federico Garcia Lorca, who is a great Spanish poet. And I'm sure that many of your readers are aware of. So I've been reading Garcia Lorca's life, very short life, and incredible amount of things that he produced. What else have I been reading? I was reading Going Over the Guns of August, which is a historical account of a fantastic book on World War I, how that insane war started. Historians are still at a loss to explain why these people were killing each other. But they were, in a very serious and horrible manner. And basically, this is the last two that I've been looking at.
Well, Tony, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a great pleasure, and I wish you well.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.